went left, the kids are going to go right. Right? that's not a universal rule, but as a rule, there's a little bit of reaction. Well, we're going to do it a little bit different than they did. So if you see something very important in one generation, a lot of times in the next, well, it might be important in a different way, or it may look different. So the previous generation affects it. And then third, current events and developments. So it's not just the things that have happened up till now, but then what actually happens in your lifetime shapes that generation and becomes defining elements of that. The theoretical part I'm going to give you tonight, and I want to emphasize the word theory. That means that you don't have to buy into it. This is just one way of thinking about the way generations work. It's kind of a helpful way of thinking about things. It's not always true, okay? It's just a way of thinking about it, is that there seems to be kind of a pattern of four generations that repeat themselves over and over. There's kind of a cycle. We see it a little bit in the Bible, and we see it in the 20th century. There are some historians that claim they see it back for centuries and centuries. Again, I'm not convinced it's quite that good a theory, but it is interesting that you do see certain patterns that just come up over and over again in different ways. So let's take a look at those four generations. The first of those four would be a struggle generation. So there's some kind of crisis that happens, something enormous and world-changing, and that's the generation that responds to that problem. Okay. The next generation tries to kind of maintain what the group before them did. That group before them survived whatever terrible event it was, and we respect them and honor them, and we want to keep that going. The third generation, sometimes called the upheaval group, says, well, things have been going pretty well, but they could be a lot better. And they start to really question the values that have been going now for two generations, and you get a lot of pretty radical changes in the third generation. The fourth generation is stuck with all the consequences. They don't like anything, right? Nothing that was changed works. Everything's bad, and they tend to be a bit cynical and pragmatic. And then, in theory, we're about due for another crisis, and you start all over again, okay? Now, that sounds a little bit like fortune-telling. So, again, I want to emphasize this is just a theoretical way of looking at it. But I want to point out that it is something that we sometimes see. Let me see if I can get over. Here we go. We do sometimes see in the scriptures. Can you advance my slide? I'm having all kinds of clicker trouble. It's all right. There we go. Okay. Let me show you that in the Bible we get a little picture of this. I'm going to do this as quickly as possible. If you want to jot down these passages and mention them later, fine. If not, I'm not going to turn and read them all. But in the start of kind of the Jewish story, you get a four-generation cycle that's very neat and tidy like this. So the struggle generation is our Exodus group. Okay? So they're born in Egypt in slavery. Things are terrible. Pharaoh doesn't like them. Moses comes in. They leave Egypt. They go out into the wilderness, and things go well in the wilderness, right? No. Wilderness is tough. And in fact, it turns out they all die there. But that's their generation, is the story of the Exodus. So if you read Deuteronomy 34, it retells that story. We're the generation that left Egypt. We're the generation that came all the way out here to the Jordan River and got this far. We're the generation that survived the wilderness. Okay, so that's your struggle generation that really wanted to survive and overcome the obstacles in their particular set of problems. They didn't create the problems. They didn't start being Egyptian slaves that day. They inherited some of that from their parents, but they're the generation that overcame it through Moses. The next generation is pretty happy with that. They have been told, you've come out of Egypt, here's the Jordan River, go take the land. And they say, great. And so they go over, and that's the story of Joshua. Joshua is the second generation guy. If Moses is the first, Joshua gets the handoff, and he's supposed to go and lead the people and build cities, and they greatly respect their parents who came out of Egypt and want to continue the story of inheriting the promised land. They want to keep things going. So they had to build on the circumstances inherited by the past. And if they have a motto, Joshua is told, be strong and very courageous. You just keep on going, right? You've been given, they've already been through the worst of it. You just keep on going into the promised land and it'll be yours. third generation says, yeah, but now we're in the promised land. Couldn't things be better? We don't have to act like we're the descendants of Egyptian slaves anymore. We could do things better. They want to reverse the circumstances of the past. They want to change things. And so in this case, the changes they enact, let me just be fair, changes aren't always bad. In this case, they're really, really bad. Right? All the changes they enact, they think will make things better by adopting the gods of the Philistines in whose land they now live, and that leads to chaos and destruction on every hand. Okay, and so the book of Judges, and if you, we will turn to this passage. If you want to look in Judges chapter 2, let me read Judges 2, 6 through 13. When Joshua dismissed the people of Israel went each to his inheritance to take possession of the land. And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua. Okay, so that's that second generation that just wants to carry on and do what they're supposed to do. And all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great work that the Lord had done for Israel. So they remember the previous generation and what had happened, and they want to keep on keeping on. Okay. And Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110 years, and they buried him within the boundaries of the inheritance of Timnath-Heres in the hill country of Ephraim. I'm in Judges, aren't I? Yeah, okay, make sure I'm in my place. North of the mountains of Gaash. And all that generation also were gathered to their fathers, and there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done for Israel. So that third group is separated enough from the events of Egypt that for them, that doesn't really tell them how they have to live. They grew up in the promised land. And so they want to ask the questions, how should we live? What could be different? Maybe we could do things different. And that gets them into all manner of trouble if you keep reading. The people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals, and they abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, who brought them out of the land of Egypt. They went after other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were around them and bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger, and on and on and on and on. Okay. Which brings us to that next group. The children of this group may be described in verses 14 and 15. Let me read that. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he gave them over to the plunderers who plundered them, and he sold them into the hand of their surrounding enemies, so they could no longer withstand their enemies. Whenever they marched out, the hand of the Lord was against them for harm, as the Lord had warned, and as the Lord had sworn to them, and they were in terrible distress. So that next generation grows up not in the sweet, beautiful, promised land, but in they are slaves in their own land, right? Their parents made a mess of it, and that fourth group is just grows up in that, and that's normal. Okay. So they're just trying to survive the mistakes of the past. Does that make kind of sense how those four generations work out? Is this an ironclad pattern? No, not at all. But just as a general storyline, a lot of the book of Judges just repeats this over and over and over again. So like in verse 16, then the Lord raised up judges. So what happened when they were in trouble in Egypt? There was a crisis, and God rushed in and saved them, and that generation came out. Here we are, maybe four generations later, and what does God do? He sends someone to rescue them in their own land now. And it says he raised up judges who saved them out of the hand of those who plundered them, yet they did not listen to their judges. So they whored after other gods and bowed down to them, and they soon turned aside from the way in which their fathers had walked, who had obeyed the commandments of the Lord, and they did not do so. So again, there's a generation that says, oh, we need God to get us out of this. They turn to God, things get better, things get worse, we do it again. Okay, and that cycle in Judges just repeats itself over and over and over again all the way through the book. If anything, in the book of Judges, each cycle gets worse. Even the judges are lousy by the end of Judges, right? The first judges, you got Deborah and Barak and Gideon, pretty good fella, right? At the end, you got Samson. Samson's kind of a mess, isn't he? Right? It's a hard story to tell at VBS because he's kind of not a great person. He's really strong, and the kids like that part, but he's not a good human being. So even by the end of Judges, even the judges aren't really great. Each cycle gets a little worse, actually, until you get to the story of Samuel later on and Eli. Okay. So what we want to try to suggest then today is that a church like ours is made up of all of those groups, especially today in American culture. Why would it be different today? One thing that makes it a little different is that you guys are living longer. If you're having kids at certain ages, that you might have quite often in a room five generations of people under the same roof. Okay, that happens in a church on a Sunday morning fairly regular, from top to bottom. So in the New Testament church, they may have only had three or four generations under one roof. In our churches, because of how long we live, we do actually have a bigger range. So what I want to talk about tonight is just to understand who we have in the room. This section is not strictly speaking biblical, right? I'm just taking that pattern we kind of looked at and saying, does the last century or so kind of look anything like that? Is there anything we can learn about each other? Okay. So this is delicate, and here's what I mean by that. I'm going to be telling you what you're like. It's that nobody likes that. Nobody wants me to tell you, here's who you are. You've made a mess, right? That's no fun. But I'm just going to go through, in typical generation theory, here's who we would have in our assembly. It's all stereotypes, but in general terms, it's kind of helpful sometimes to think of it this way, in terms of five generations. The generation that's currently passing, that we have almost none of left, those that we have are absolutely treasures to us, are the generation called the Builder Generation, or the Greatest Generation, born between 1901 and 1924. All these dates are fuzzy. It's not like on that day they started being different, right? But just in general, this is the crowd that survived the Great Depression and World War II. Okay? How old are they today? Yeah, they're nearing a century, if not already, right? Okay. This is the crowd that really... I didn't even look at you, Larry. Didn't even look over there. This crowd, whoever they may be, right? Our churches are losing them at a very fast pace. I got invited to a meeting... let me see. It'll be in early April at a professor's house, and he's invited some ministers over. There was a study done recently on ages in churches of Christ, and some of it's kind of scary number-wise, and they wanted to talk to some ministers about it, and I'll be down there in Edmond in April to chat about it. I'm not convinced of their data yet, but it is interesting. But one of the trends is about, you know, that generation that was pretty dependable is definitely, if not past, is passing very, very quickly. Okay, that crowd. And so what does that do for our churches? One of the things we'll probably end up talking about. So, okay, they grew up, they were born during World War I in the Roaring Twenties, but they came of age and lived as adults, Great Depression, World War II, the Greatest Generation. How do they see the world? There was a crisis and they responded. I mean, across the board. We'll stop making cosmetics and start making bullets. You need more battleships, we'll turn car factories into making battleships. We'll do whatever it takes. Will respond and go do it. If you'd asked their parents if they were capable of it, they would have said, oh no, these kids are a mess. But they did it, right? I mean, something happened and they turned it up a notch and they got it done and responded and shaped the entire 20th century by their response to the crisis that they faced. And there's a reason we call them the Greatest Generation. Okay. Their goal was to build for the future, to make something that lasts. They came back from World War II, and they traded in their GI greens for business suit and coat and went to work. And they worked at the same job their whole lives, and they built things that lasted. That was their goal in life. In the little book I've been reading that talks about some of this in brief, it likes at the end of every chapter to say, what was the theme song of this generation, if you have to give them a theme song? And for this group, the song My Way. Now, interesting, it wasn't written until the 60s. That's when Sinatra makes it famous. But in the 70s, becomes the most requested non-church song at funeral homes as this wave starts to begin to pass. That it was that group, as they retired, connected with that song. I did it my way. We survived. We did fine. I paid my dues, right? And that, like, really connected with them. And funeral home director said, you know, we had to keep it on standby because everyone wanted that song for that generation. It meant a lot to them, okay? The generation that follows, you can guess, born somewhere between 1925 and 1942. Those are fuzzy numbers, okay? Sometimes called the traditionalists, okay? Now, this group might have been born during the Great Depression or World War II, possibly, but they didn't live during it, right? I mean, that was just part of the story for them. My dad was born on December 16th of 1940, and so he likes to joke. I remember Pearl Harbor like it was yesterday, you know. And no, you don't. So, yeah, that was an event that was going on at the time he was born, but not something that had anything to do with him, right? The war was over by the time he was in the military, right? That wasn't his life. But he was that next group, okay? So they were born during Great Commission, World War II, Great Depression, World War II, but they didn't live that out. They had a lot of faith in their parents. One of the jokes in the book is that this generation's motto was, "Yes, sir." Their parents had survived the worst events that history could throw at them, and they really wanted to continue that. And so they were very respectful of the previous generation. They wanted to continue to help that generation to do the work, to work under them, to work with them, and was a very reverent and respectful generation in that way. A lot of work ethic is characterized with them. Their goal was to improve and continue what their parents had done, to take the handoff and then hand it right down to the next. The book made the comment, if they had a theme song, it's America the Beautiful, right? You gave us a great country, and we're going to hand it off, right? They wanted to continue what they had been given. Does that resonate with anybody? I'm just going to look right up at the sky, right? But in principle, we should have some folks in the room that fall into that category. Does that kind of say, yeah, that's kind of who my people are, that age group? Anybody kind of want to say, yeah, no? Hope you get a chance to tell me I'm completely wrong if you're ready. You're there? Is that kind of hits? Okay, yeah. Some of that, yeah. And not every point. Again, these are generalities, aren't they, right? They're huge stereotypes. But just a way of thinking about how that crowd saw the world and sees the world. Okay, now what about their children? In our three-generation theory, you got the crisis, they survived it, and the maintenance, they wanted to keep things going. What happened in the third group? Upheaval. We can do better. It's all Keith's fault, right? So this would be what we typically call the baby boomer generation, 1943 to 1960. Okay, so they grew up at the beginning of the Cold War, and in their mind, things weren't as great as you thought they were, and things could be changed. Now here, the boomers get blamed for a lot, so I'll say some nice things and some mean things, right? They're very idealistic. In many ways, the changes they enacted, some of them were for the better. So what would be one that changed the world for the better? The civil rights movement, right? Demanding equality from across the board in our country. That was something this crowd did. They said, we're not going to stand for it anymore. This is the way it's going to be. And we're very vocal about that. Okay, I'm glad. That was an improvement. I'm glad we don't have different water fountains for different sorts of ethnicities, right? That was a good change, a revolution that they brought about. Another one was the sexual revolution. Not as thrilled about the outcome of that one, okay? That there was a change of the view of sexuality, of marriage, and a lot of things that we're still paying dividends on and consequences for today. But you see, this was a group that was very idealistic, and there was nothing they couldn't change. And nothing was sacred, nothing was off limits. They could change everything. When they got a hold of something that was really bad, they changed it for the better, and I'm grateful. When they got a hold of something that wasn't that bad to start with, sometimes they threw out baby and bathwater and left us with some problems. They really believed in idealism, in change, in action, and going out and doing things, transforming the culture. When was the last time a preacher read you a Bob Dylan song lyric during a class, right? Their theme song comes from The Times They Are A-Changin'. Come senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. There's a battle outside and it's raging. It'll soon shake your windows and rattle your walls, for the times, they are a-changing. Come mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand, for the times, they are a-changing. That's kind of the theme song that really captures the sentiment of a lot of that generation. Not everybody? No, of course not. But a lot of that historical movement was caught up in that sentiment. Okay. Any boomers want to confess? I've already called out Keith now. You're not even boomer. Oh, okay. Sorry. My bad. You're just a kid. I'm looking at the. I'm trying to look at the picture in the corner and see who that would be. I can't tell.
Mm-hmm. World War II was the appearance of absolute evil to any human who was alive.
Yes.
They absolutely knew this was abject, sinister evil, and it had to be stopped with certainty, black, white.
Black and white.
That's
yep.
True. That's your outlook. And Great Depression, the same way, we're all going to starve if we don't make some
right. It was stark absolutes.
Yeah.
What did I leave out of this group? Vietnam, right?
The product of their non-event, and I don't mean the Cold War wasn't a thing.
No. Cold War, Vietnam, and those things, they weren't as stark and clear as World War II had been. The world, to at least a lot of people, it looked grayer than the Holocaust, which looked like just the epitome of evil, right? And so it was harder for some people to say, maybe it's not as clear as our parents thought, you see. That's a good observation, that those events shape the way people think. Okay. So we had our crisis generation. We had our maintenance generation who wanted to carry on. We had our upheaval generation. So next is that sad, sad survival generation. We just got to get by. And that's the group, the MTV generation, Gen X, 1961 to 1980. Do you want to be in that category now? Is that where you're going to land? See, you can't. You already opted out of the other one. You're stuck now. You're in Gen X. Sorry about you. Right? They grew up. They were born during the Civil Rights Movement, but again, they didn't live through it. They lived through a lot of the consequences of those decisions. So my older brother is like your prototype Gen X guy, and I love my brother to death. But like when I'm reading this chapter, he like checks every box, and I was laughing at it with him about it. He grew up in Arkansas when Dad was preaching there, and they did some busing where, in kind of response to the Civil Rights Movement, we're going to move some kids. So he was the white kid getting bused over to the black school in Arkansas, and he said it was kind of a weird experience and has some odd stories to tell about how he experienced that, right? Something that seemed like, well, we need to make these changes, for him played out in kind of awkward ways. Does that make sense? He's not opposed to the Civil Rights Movement, I want to be clear. but for him, it was an awkward time to be a young person. Does that make sense? So that's his story, the way he tells it. And divorce, so the sexual revolution happened. Gen X kids have the highest rate of divorced parents, even more than now. The divorce rates dropped in the 90s, if you can believe that. This crowd had the highest rates of divorce. And so they are very cynical people about some of those things. And I don't want to say that in a mean way, okay? But what's that? Hippies and the drugs. You blame disco. Clearly has something to do with disco. They tend to be individualists. They tend to have some pessimism. When I sit and talk, my brother is one of my favorite human beings, and I love to sit and talk to Clint. But if I talk very long to Clint, eventually he will start to tell me why the world is this way, right? That it becomes very cynical conversation. You know, they're all spying on us anyway. Have you seen how Facebook works? And he's got you know, like an explanation of everything bad in the world. That's probably his parents' fault, right? I mean, that the generation before us made a wreck, and here we are stuck with it. And this crowd is very practical. So Randy was telling me they did the Survivor episodes where they had millennials versus Gen X. And the millennials, we'll get to in a minute, they're all, the first day they're there, they're playing on the beach and enjoying the waves and stuff, and the Gen X guys are out there like with hatchets making shelters. They're very practical, right? And then at night, the millennials are like, where are we going to sleep? Gen Xers are in bed. Okay, so they're a very practical crowd. They really just want to get down to business. They turned out to be, no one thought this, when you call them the MTV generation, no one thought they were going to be hard workers. It turns out, in the workforce, they're pretty hard workers, by and large, very practical people. If you want to rant about how lazy millennials are, talk to somebody from Generation X. My brother can tell you how hard it is to hire anybody that he likes. He has an intern now. It's a long story. But anyway, yeah, right? It's kind of scary. Yeah. Yeah.
They're not the equal of their grandparents, but they will work a day.
Yeah. So it's going to be automated. Yeah, don't worry about it. We got robots for that. So this is, how about some Kevin Gilbert? This is goodness gracious excerpt that, okay. Goodness gracious, at the mercy of the crooks, we're broken. There's no way too many cooks, and every pot a pink slip, and every mouth a hook. Goodness gracious, I'm not listening anymore, because the spooks are in the White House, and they've justified a war, so wake me when they notify we're going to fight some more. Goodness gracious, not many people care. Concern is getting scarcer, true compassion really rare. I can see it on our faces, I can feel it in the air. Goodness gracious me. Goodness gracious, my generation's lost. They burned down all our bridges before we had a chance to cross. Is it the winter of our discontent or just an early frost? Goodness gracious, this is a good one. Goodness gracious, of apathy I sing. The baby boomers had it all and wasted everything. Now recess is almost over and they won't get off the swing. Goodness gracious, we came in at the end. No sex that isn't dangerous, no money left to spend. We're the cleanup crew for parties we were too young to attend. Goodness gracious me. Goodness gracious, my grandma used to say, the world's a scary place now. Things are different in her day. What horrors will be commonplace when my hair start to gray? That's the Gen X song. And if you sit down and talk to my older brother, like that's exactly it. I am turning gray, and that's the way the world is, and it's a mess, right? And so they have a fair bit of pessimism that comes with a fair bit of practicality because they feel like this world's a mess, and they don't know. They don't expect it. Our parents were idealists. We could change anything. These guys don't think they can change anything. It's a different point of view. Okay. Yes?
One reason why the older generation don't mix as well with the younger generation is that we don't understand all the problems.
Yeah.
We don't understand that you're supposed to be on social media instead of doing education.
Yeah. So one of the things we mentioned early on, what shapes generation, like the big historical trends. So the development of technology changes people in the same way. It's a genie you can't put back in the bottle. I mean, the printing press happened. The internet happened. We have to kind of deal with them. But especially the first few generations that deal with them don't have wisdom to go with it yet, right? You just have something and we don't know what to do. And sometimes we make terrible mistakes. Sometimes we write good books and say, this is what we're going to do. But it definitely does, technology does shape generations in both positive and negative ways as it develops. It has to. Yeah. So the next group, 1981 through 2001. Again, I deeply suspect that 1981 year, because that makes me a millennial. I'm 82. I'm right on the cusp. So my complaint has been that I'll be whichever one I want, thank you. So when I'm cranky at Gen X people, I say, yeah, those pessimists, they're lousy. And then when I'm cranky at millennials, yeah, those sluggardly millennials, go get them. But anyway, millennials, some were born in the 80s and 90s. Today they're in their 30s by and large, early 20s, or late 20s rather. They're that crowd that's growing up now. They actually had stronger homes than their parents did. The divorce rate did tick down in those years, so they're more likely to have grown up in a two-parent home. May not have been a healthy two-parent home, but they grew up in a healthier home, if that makes sense. In four-generation theory, this is now our crisis generation. We didn't have one, right? 9/11 was a significant world-altering event, but in the everyday life of the average American young person, unless you enlisted, it didn't actually change. You didn't go to work in a factory making battleships. Does that make sense? That it didn't change things. And it changed air travel. It changed security protocol. It changed some things. It didn't change the ordinary experience of a person. So one thing that's being commented on, and I'll just say, especially with millennials, I still think it's too early to comment that Devin and I have talked about generations that are too self-aware that say, this is who we are. Well, if you're 20, you don't get to tell me who you are yet, right? You're not done cooking, so we're still working on it. I don't know who the millennials will turn out to be, but one thing we notice is they have not had a world-altering dilemma to overcome, like World War II. And so kind of what they'll do next, we don't know. For those guys, there are a lot of millennials who, so 1982, my birthday, 9/11 happened my freshman year of college. I know, it's going to make some of you feel old, deal with it. Okay, freshman year in college, 9/11 happened. A lot of my peers went and enlisted and have been in the military ever since. Makes sense? And so there is a crowd of millennials that are have spent their entire adult life in Afghanistan or Iraq. And that crowd really was changed by that. And I'm curious kind of how they'll develop. Jeff, how old are you?
30.
30? And how many years over yonder?
10 years enlisted, 2.5, 3 over.
So, I mean, just talk about how we talk about stereotypes. Same generation as somebody else who's 30 years old, but the difference in experiences of life are going to be substantial from, say, Dalton, who hadn't spent the time over there, right, in the same age group, more or less. Okay. 20 what?
29.
So very close in age, very different life experiences. Whereas World War II, no one escaped the consequences of World War II. And so a whole generation was shaped by it. Millennials, it's kind of hit or miss about which events affected them in which ways. And that's not to say that the veterans will all come out better, because as we're finding out, they come back with their own problems, don't they, right? I mean, there's their own set of problems there that we have to deal with that come from a warfare environment. By and large, what are some of the stereotypes of millennials? They're family-focused. They're very deeply interested in their kids, sometimes to a fault. If Facebook is any indication, all they want to do is take pictures of their kids at the park and stuff. I mean, that's kind of their life and livelihood. Tuesday, I took a day off, spring break, took my kids down to the gathering place here in Tulsa, and I was there with, I think, 11 billion other parents and their kids. Every kid in Tulsa must have been at that park that day. And all of them, you know, taking pictures of each other, right? And that was kind of the experience of the park that day. It was kind of fascinating. So they're very family-focused. They tend to be optimistic. So Gen X tend to say, that's the way the world is. The millennials are optimistic, again, to a fault. Like, well, the world's going to be better. Maybe even if I don't do anything about it, it might just get better. Right? Even if I don't get a career, things might be okay. To a point where it can become naive, can't it? Where we worry about their work ethic and how they're going to turn out. But they're very optimistic. They think things could be better. What is their goal? Being happy. Well, that's not the worst goal. It's not the best goal either, right? Because there are some hard things that have to happen before you get to happiness and contentment. And sometimes that generation wants to skip it right to the end, and that's a problem. So we're not sure how they're going to grow up. I don't know what their theme song is yet. Maybe it hasn't been written. But this is the group. This is the group everyone's worried about right now. It's the biggest group since the baby boomers in terms of size. It's a larger generation than those that have gone before it. They are disproportionately, every generation has got a little less interested in church. Boomers are just now coming back to church. We talked about that last week. Gen X is a really hard group when it comes to church. They have very different expectations. Millennials are deeply involved in community activities. Volunteerism among millennials is higher than any other generation. They're more likely to volunteer to clean up the park or to go feed the homeless or something like that than any generation that's alive today. Their volunteer rate is through the roof. But they don't feel like they need to be a part of a church to do that. In fact, they say churches usually just get in the way of that. So they tend to want to be involved in other organizations. Ma'am? Yeah. I really do think they want to change the world, and they have no idea how. Like, there wasn't a moment that said, here, go fight the Nazis, right? So they're kind of wandering around trying to find themselves, and then they have no idea what they're doing, right, in some ways. And
you know, the boomers wanted to change the world without knowing a better way.
Yeah.
And I really see these millennials are bright, and I know you can't stereotype the generation.
No.
But they're sharp.
Yeah.
And I really, there's some hope there.
Yeah. They grew up with a lot of information. So this is the first generation that grew up with almost universal internet access. By the time they were in high school, they grew up with dial-up. By the time they were in high school, they had internet, cell phones. So they, as far as information, there is more information available to that group than ever in human history. But you know, wisdom and information aren't the same thing. So what do I do with that, and how do I live a life is another set of questions. Dalton?
Do you think technology might be a crisis?
Well, it may be that it'll be a subtle crisis. Like, it could be something like, what do we do with technology? We'll define this generation. Sexuality has turned out to be a strange crisis. I was having a conversation with an elder today about the development of the gender identity crisis. And it may be this is the generation has to figure out what bathrooms look like. I mean, it may be that's where we're at, and that it's not going to be fighting the Nazis. It's going to be something much closer to home. I just have no idea how that'll plan out because I'm not a fortune teller, but yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there is a strong correlation between social media and mental illness, and so we may have a whole generation of bad mental health that we have to struggle with. I don't know. Not a fortune teller, but those are options. What comes next? So my kids are the next group. And there are already people writing books about this group. Let me just give you some advice. Don't read any books written about this group. If they're 9 years old, you have no idea how they're going to turn out. Okay, so just don't even try. They are a unique group. They are the first generation that's going to grow up in a world of touchscreens. I had to show Lucas what a mouse was for. He said, why doesn't the computer work? And I said, well, it's complicated. There's a thing down here that everything is touchable, right? And so that was kind of interesting. That it is definitely a different way of interfacing with the world. It's way too early to say. And for generation theory, this would be your next group of traditionalists. They would say, let's keep things the way they are, and we haven't figured out what the way things are yet, right? So it's kind of interesting what wanted to see a movie. What was involved in seeing a movie? Keith, pick on you. Tell me the first movie you went to see in a theater. Did they have talkies then? Is that? No, I'm just kidding. Sorry. That's me. Sound of Music? Okay. You went and you saw it in a theater. Why was it important to see it in a theater? It was the only place you could see it. Okay? Like that experience only existed in one place. Okay? Now, the frequent conversation I have is, do we want to wait till it's out on Netflix or do we want to go see it? Why would I pay $18? It'll be on my screen at home in a few days, right? I'll just wait. And it's a whole different way that information will be there. For Lucas, that's permanent. I remember the first time Calvin saw a commercial. Had never watched regular television. Had only ever watched, it was easier to put Netflix on if he wanted to watch one of his cartoons, and there weren't commercials. And he had to stop in the middle of his show for 30 seconds while someone tried to sell him something. And he says, what did you do with my show? I said, this is a commercial. What's that? And Lucas says, well, it's kind of like an ad. And I said, Yeah, it's an advertisement. And Lucas says, it's something on old TV. I said, no, you're not old TV. It's regular television. What do you mean? But those little subtle things like that are just add up and snowball into a very large differences in how you experience the world.
I showed Dr. Hamilton's class last week, a 12-inch
man. Uh-huh. Black and white movie? Yeah. 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 Never mind not knowing who Fonda was. Where's the color? Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, it's a very different experience. How we do evangelism. Any of you guys work with Jewel Miller film strips? And it goes ding, and you turn the slide, right? I mean, now even the VHS version of those are antiquated, of course. And it's actually hard to find any now. But the methods of, like, this is a neat thing. We're going to bring this projector into the house. We're going to put this on and play it. That was like an event that a family would enjoy and sit and engage in. In a Netflix world, it doesn't make sense to wheel in a slide projector, right, and say, well, let's try that. So how those groups interact with the world and information, totally different. So what we're going to try to do next week is I'm going to prepare you for this now so you're not caught off guard. Next week, this class is going to be in the fellowship hall. Okay, I know. I'm going to try to put comfy chairs over there for you, but it's going to be over there. Why? Because I don't want to lecture for 45 minutes. What I want to do is give you a handout. If you want to take one home tonight and look it over, you can cheat and get ahead. But it has some discussion questions out of the book of Proverbs about wisdom and knowledge and passing it on. And we're going to segregate you a little bit. Honor system, you have to figure out how to do it. We're going to put older folks on one side, younger-ish folks in between. Guys like Keith who don't know where they are just going to have to fill in gaps, right? You just go wherever you find a chair. And the class, I'll open up by introducing what we're talking about that week, but the class is going to be designed for discussion, not you talking to me, but for you talking about these questions with the people on the other side of the table who are going to be younger than you or older than you, to kind of force you to do the awkward thing of talking to other people. And we're going to try this for a few weeks and see what comes of it. If we're serious about being a congregation that works together and talks together, the only way I know how to do it is sit down at a table and do it sometime. So for a few weeks, we're going to give it a shot and see what happens. I think we might find out we kind of like each other, that people across generations have a lot of common values that they can share and love about each other. We just have to kind of rediscover those. Okay, that's next week.